It is Monday, July 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Russian President Vladimir Putin says there must be a reduction of 755 people in the U.S. diplomatic mission.
Russia is not the main interest of the American public. It is about the economy, it's about jobs, it's about the future. And this is low down on the list, and it's going to push it lower.
Time is running out for U.S. President Donald Trump's domestic policy initiatives, and we look at security along the U.S.-Canadian border. It's all ahead. Russian President Vladimir Putin said the United States will have to pare its diplomatic staff in the country by 755 people by September 1st. In apparent retaliation for new U.S. sanctions over Russia's Ukraine policy and alleged meddling in last year's U.S. election. That's a charge Moscow has denied. Washington called the Kremlin's action regrettable and uncalled for and said the U.S. is weighing how to respond. Russia's U.S. Ambassador Sergei Ryabkov appeared Sunday on the ABC program This Week.
This retaliation is long, long overdue. After the Senate, the day before yesterday, voted, or rather on the 27th of July, voted so overwhelmingly on a completely weird and unacceptable piece of legislation, it was the last drop. If the U.S. side decides to move further towards further deterioration, we will answer, we will respond in kind.
Ryabkov warned of possible further actions and said bilateral cooperation on matters like non-proliferation, counterterrorism, illicit immigration, climate change, and human trafficking will suffer. Yet, he added, Russia continues to stretch its hand forward, hoping for a reversal of fortunes. University of Denver International Affairs professor Jonathan Alderman tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, there's a political irony in this for President Donald Trump.
For Donald Trump, this is great. He's being accused of colluding with the Russians, doing all sorts of things. And by going along with this, he answers his detractors, who are very numerous at this time, and says, well, if I were so, why would I be punishing them? If you look at public opinion polling data, Russia is not the main interest of the American public. It is about the economy, it's about jobs, it's about the future. And this is low down on the list, and it's going to push it lower.
President Trump and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson have expressed numerous times their desire to improve relations with Russia, which sank to lows during the previous Obama administration. Is it possible that these two countries can have good relations?
I think it's going to be very difficult because there's such an imbalance in terms of their economic capability, in terms of the democracy versus authoritarianism. For this administration, and when you look at the hardliners, very tough people who just joined this administration, they're going to be telling Donald, don't do anything until you get past this issue about collusion, because that is something which the Republicans have been, you know, pushed very hard on by the Democrats. They may even say in quiet that they're relieved. Let Putin come on after us. That way we can get rid of this and go to our issue, which is Hillary Clinton and the Russians. I mean, this nonsense goes on forever.
What about Ukraine? Can Russia possibly change policy in Ukraine, or is it too late?
I think it's definitely too late. Putin has made it very clear that he's not Nazi Germany. He's not one of those leaders that wants to kill everybody in the other countries. But he wants those slices of other countries which were lost after 1991, whether it's Crimea, whether it's southern Ossetia, whether it's Abkhazia, or whether it's part of the West Bank of Ukraine. He wants those areas which were predominantly Russian at the time of the Russian Empire. And so I don't think he's going to give it up for a very simple reason. He doesn't have much else to offer at home.
Jonathan Adelman, professor at the University of Denver. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, we start with some sad news today. Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, Academy Award-nominated actor Sam Shepard has passed away at the age of 73 after suffering from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, better known as ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. a major figure in American stage and screen, and being remembered for a lot of his different roles on the stage and the screen, a lot of the plays that he's written, particularly the role of Chuck Yeager, the pilot who broke the sound barrier in the film The Right Stuff. That was the movie for which Sam Shepard was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. But fellow actors mourning their friend and fans remembering his talent today. And another name that's trending, John Kelly, sworn in today as President Trump's new chief of staff. Can he get a chaotic White House in order? That is the question on social media. President Trump seeming to do some pre-budding on Twitter, saying that it's the highest stock market ever, the borders are secure, wages are rising, and he closes that tweet saying, no White House chaos. So we'll see how that narrative plays out in the coming days, weeks, and months.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. In Somalia, an al-Shabaab militant is killed in a U.S. airstrike. Retired Marine Corps General John Kelly becomes the White House Chief of Staff. WikiLeaks publishes 20,000 leaked emails from French President Emmanuel Macron's campaign. And suicide bombers storm the Iraqi embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA. This is International Edition. The U.S. Republican-held Congress is running out of time to finish major legislative initiatives like a health care overhaul and tax reform, two key pledges of President Trump's campaign platform. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman tells VOA's Jim Stevenson the Senate this past week heard from an ailing Republican veteran on how to get back on track after months of bickering.
John McCain's return to the Senate this past week was highly anticipated because, of course, he is a revered man and he has been in the institution for a very long time. He has been a standard bearer of the Republican Party, and he had this devastating cancer diagnosis, a particularly lethal form of brain cancer. And yet just a few days after that diagnosis, he shows up in Washington. Just as the decisive votes are going to be cast in the healthcare debate, he first voted to begin debate. But at the same time, he delivered this speech saying that the entire process by which Republicans were attempting to change the healthcare system was flawed. It was relying only on Republicans, that it should be bipartisan. And then a few days later, when it came to actually voting on a Republican plan that would have repealed key segments of Obamacare, John McCain voted no. And he sort of solidified his maverick status, which was the way that he liked to be regarded during the 2008 presidential campaign when he ran against Barack Obama. And ironically enough, the man who may have saved Obamacare could be the man who was defeated by Barack Obama in 2008, John McCain.
Now we also have work beginning on the much anticipated economic package.
Jim, we are in the waning few hours of July, which means August is just around the corner. Traditionally, both houses of Congress are gone for the entire month of August and actually into the first week of September. Here is what is on the plate just for the coming months. Congress has to pass a spending bill. Congress has to deal with the fact that America's spending authority, the U.S. government's spending authority, is reaching its limit. It's reaching its ceiling. So the debt ceiling has to be increased. If President Trump wants any sort of tax reform, which was one of the sort of centerpieces of his campaign and something that Republicans have been dreaming of for years, that is something that must be tackled very shortly. If there's to be any kind of infrastructure package, that has to be tackled. And all of this is happening during what I think we can fairly say is a period of fairly intense chaos within the White House and some really strained relationships between President Trump and the men who should be his top lieutenants on Capitol Hill. Hill. I don't know how this extremely ambitious agenda, and it was ambitious back in January when Donald Trump raised his hand and took the oath of office. So much has happened since then. We have a White House with sort of a revolving door of who is actually serving President Trump. All of this chaos, it's going to be very interesting to see how Republicans try to deal with arguably the most ambitious legislative agenda attempted by anybody in recent memory in such a short period of time.
On the surface, you would think a Republican-held White House, Senate, House of Representatives, it would be a breeze.
Well, it would be a breeze in the parliamentary system, but of course we don't have the parliamentary system. Legislation has to go through two houses of Congress. And let's not forget that, you know, trying to get lawmakers to agree on anything is somewhat like herding cats. Let's also not forget that Republicans are trying to do genuinely big ticket things. We're not talking about renaming post offices. If you're talking about restructuring America's healthcare system, well, gosh, that accounts for 1/6 of the U.S. economy. If you're talking about restructuring America's tax system, well, that's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pages long. And there are vested interests in all of this. This is not in any way an easy lift, and Republicans are starting to realize that.
Despite the seeming dysfunction on the Hill and in the White House, things run smoothly at the VOA Senate booth, and Michael Bowman is there each and every day, and we are honored to be able to chat with you each week.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thank you.
In other news, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro went on national television to hail Sunday's vote for a new assembly to rewrite the country's constitution aimed at ending years of economic, social, and political turmoil. He said voters overcame numerous challenges to vote for the Constitutional National Assembly. The official voter turnout was more than 40%, or more than 8 million voters, despite an opposition boycott. The United States condemned the vote Sunday to replace the opposition-led National Assembly, saying it undermines the people's right to self-determination. Peru's government is organizing a meeting of Latin American foreign ministers on what it calls Venezuela's illegitimate vote. Jeff Ramsey, Venezuela researcher at the Washington Office on Latin America, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty Sunday's turnout was far less than that achieved during the opposition-led referendum against the new assembly July 16th. He estimated only about 2 million cast ballots. But Ramsey was not surprised Mr. Maduro claimed victory.
I think absolutely. You know, I think from the very beginning, this vote was slanted against the opposition, and it's frankly illegitimate. And I think absolutely the government is going to use this to create a constituent assembly. That body is going to have about 3 days to convene and elect its own leadership that will have unprecedented power over the rest of Venezuela's remaining democratic institutions.
I know you don't have a crystal ball, but can you give us a sense of what you think might happen?
I think that it's pretty clear that the government is trying to use this new body, the Constituent Assembly, to govern, to attempt to give itself a more legitimate claim to dissolving certain obstacles in its eyes, like the opposition-controlled legislature, as well as the authority to dismiss internal critics, like Attorney General Luis Ortega, who's been a thorn in the side of the government for the last several months.
What does the opposition do now? Do we resort to civil disobedience or even violence in the streets, as we've begun to see?
It is a concern. The fact that we saw an attack on police officers today in eastern Caracas suggests that frustration with the government is building. There's an increasing lack of devotion to nonviolent protest tactics, and I think that's very much a concern. Those of us that are watching Venezuela and following developments on the ground know that there is a very real possibility for the situation to turn into a civil conflict down the road.
Is the army the key to resolving this matter?
Absolutely. Maduro is relying on the loyalty of the armed forces. The government of Hugo Chavez before him and him as well have given military commanders certain benefits. There's been a long-standing system of patronage to the military leadership in Venezuela. And because of that, they've been able to buy the loyalty of the armed forces to a certain degree. However, I think that as we see increasing repression, like we've been seeing in the last couple of months, the possibility of some kind of fracture in the armed forces is very real, and that would be bad news for Maduro.
The U.S. has vowed swift and robust sanctions. What would those sanctions look like?
It's a bit unclear at this point exactly what that's going to look like, but it is becoming somewhat more clear that that's going to include some level of economic sanctions against the oil sector in Venezuela. Frankly, I think that would be devastating to the already debilitated Venezuelan economy. These broad sanctions against what is essentially the only motor keeping the Venezuelan economy going would have a very grave humanitarian toll.
At least 10 people died in anti-government protests Sunday. More than 120 have died in clashes since early April. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Breakthrough Starshot program say they successfully launched a number of tiny space probes into low Earth orbit on June 23rd. Each of these miniature probes, called Sprites, are built on a single 3.5 by 3.5 centimeter circuit board. Although the Sprites only weigh about 4 grams each, they contain items needed for interstellar missions, such as solar panels, computers, sensors, and radios. Breakthrough Starshot say the Sprites will help them develop even smaller 1 centimeter and gram probes they plan to eventually send on a 20-year voyage to explore deep space and search for life in the universe. Renowned physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking and Russian internet investor and physicist Yuri Milner announced the Breakthrough Starshot program back in April of 2016. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. President Donald Trump's plans to build a security wall along the U.S.-Mexican border are well known. But many argue the northern U.S. border with Canada also presents a challenging security problem for both countries. There is human and drug trafficking across the border in both directions, and Border Patrol agents have limited resources to stop it. VOA's Jeff Swicord has more in this report from the Canadian-U.S. border.
Alert 3.
Three Turkish citizens are being watched illegally crossing the border into Canada along a neighborhood road monitored by U.S. agents at the Swanton, Vermont Border Patrol Station.
Alert 1.
Canadian police are waiting to arrest them on the other side. If they crossed at a normal point of entry, they would be turned back. But by crossing illegally, Canadian law allows them to seek asylum.
So you can look right here, you can see the foot sign, the tracks that people make.
Agent Brad Brandt says in the past 6 months, more than 5,000 people from around the world have made the illegal crossing into Canada.
People are entering the United States legally with a visa, a tourist visa, into JFK. They're taking a bus to Plattsburgh, New York, and a taxi to the end of the Roxham Road.
Roxham Road has been used by smugglers for decades and is one of several points in the Swanton sector that has border agents alarmed.
For a lot of regular.
The U.S.-Mexico border may get most of the attention, but after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, many experts warned a terrorist may be more likely to enter the U.S. from Canada.
You need to consider that it might be easier for that person to enter into Canada and move himself through Canada versus entering into Mexico and trying to travel through Mexico himself.
Like the southern border, the U.S. northern border with Canada has thousands of kilometers of wilderness. There are also urban areas that present unique problems, like Derby Line, Vermont, and Stanstead, Quebec, a town split in half by the border.
I believe it was 09 these gates went up, closed these roads.
Stephen Hennessy, the agent in charge in Derby Line, says the border was drawn inaccurately before the age of modern GPS technology.
Neighbors, family, they're on both sides of the border, but they see themselves as one community here, so it's...
After 9/11, townspeople were required to cross through a nearby secured point of entry. Derby Line's Haskell Library was a compromise. The border runs through the building, and townspeople from both sides wanted access to the library.
The compromise was these flower pots here that guard the road. People are allowed to walk back and forth across the border here to go to the Haskell without being inspected, so that's another one of our challenges here.
Controlling who crosses the almost 9,000 kilometers of border between the U.S. and Canada is a daunting task. Agents rely heavily on technology, such as this camera mounted on a tree that is triggered by motion. The camera watches over a cemetery located on both sides of the border, which is often used by traffickers smuggling people and contraband into the U.S. Agent Brad Brandt says the technology is useless without the boots on the ground to back it up.
Our technology will tell us if there's an intrusion, but it just tells us there's an intrusion. It may tell us as a person has come across. We may be able to identify that. But until we actually can go and talk to that person, and if they're illegal, arrest them and identify them, until we identify that person, we don't know who they are.
Jeff Swicord, VOA News, near Swanton, Vermont.
Well, husky voice French actor Jean Moreau has died at the age of 89. The French president's office announced her death Monday in a statement. American director Orson Welles once described Moreau as the best actress in the world. She received numerous awards for her work, including a Best Actress Prize at Cannes. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to the State Department's annual terrorism report for 2016, ISIS remained the most capable terrorist organization, directing and inspiring terror cells, networks, and individuals around the world. But it suffered a long string of defeats, losing much of the territory it had controlled in Syria and particularly in Iraq. As its losses mounted, ISIS dispatched operatives from Iraq and Syria to conduct attacks outside of the Middle East and also worked to inspire and encourage similar actions by its followers abroad. Al-Qaeda and its affiliates exploited weak and ineffective governments and institutions in a number of states and regions to remain a significant worldwide threat. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula remained a significant threat to Yemen, the Gulf region, and the United States, despite a number of key leadership losses. Al-Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, continued to exploit ongoing armed conflict to maintain a territorial safe haven in parts of northwestern Syria. Al-Shabaab continued to conduct asymmetric attacks throughout Somalia and parts of Kenya, despite weakened leadership and increasing defections. And in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda continued to suffer losses. Two trends continued in 2016. First, terrorist groups established safe havens in ungoverned territory and conflict zones and used them to expand their reach. And second, attacks by so-called lone offender terrorists continued, particularly against civilian targets in public spaces. And finally, Iran remained the foremost state sponsor of terrorism globally, providing support to various terrorist groups in Syria, Iraq, and throughout the Middle East. The State Department report includes a statistical annex prepared by the University of Maryland's National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, known as START. START noted that terrorist attacks declined globally by 9%, while total deaths due to terrorist attacks decreased by 13% compared to 2015. This was largely due to fewer attacks and deaths from terrorist attacks in Afghanistan, Syria, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Yemen. At the same time, there was an increase in terrorist attacks and total deaths in several countries, including Iraq, Somalia, and Turkey, said Acting Coordinator for Counterterrorism, Justin Sibirel, on the release of the report in late July. the United States will continue to devote resources toward improving counterterrorism capabilities of key partner countries, while at the same time focusing long-term efforts on addressing the drivers of violent extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.